If you would please open your Bibles to Psalm 15. In our study this morning, we're going to pursue this psalm. I'm not pleased oftentimes, as so those of you that teach, I'm sure can sympathize with this, with sometimes my accomplishments in a class. I don't get to a real good breaking point and don't get completed the thoughts sometimes before time is up. But makes it necessary to go back and tie things together that uses time. In Psalm 15, we are examining what's been cataloged as Psalms of Guidance, and this is one in particular that we want to take note of. And we noted in this chapter, that very short chapter, just five verses, that there are basically two points that are being made. Let's pause for a moment and read the text, beginning in verse 1. Jehovah, who shall sojourn in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh truth in his heart. He that slandereth not with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his friend, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honoreth them that fear Jehovah. He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not, he that putteth not out his money to interest, nor taketh reward against the innocent, he that doeth these things shall never be moved. Now just in the reading of that text, you say, well, those points are real simple, points of life. And yes, you could print that out and put that on your refrigerator and it'd probably help all of us. But as we look at the text, we see basically two points that are being established. In answer to this question, Jehovah, who shall sojourn in thy tabernacle, and who shall dwell in thy holy hill? Very simple question, isn't it? Now, the question, I don't believe, has to do with the literal tabernacle in the city or the temple in the city of Jerusalem. He's talking about who's going to heaven. Who's going to enjoy the eternal dwelling place with God? Who's going to get to be with God? Now, you'd think as simple of a question as that is, that the answer likewise ought to be simple, and it is. And we're going to look at it from both a positive and negative standpoint. If you do this, 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 then you'll get to go to heaven. If you don't, you won't. Now, is that simple enough? And that's the points, essentially, that he is establishing. So we want to look at that. Integrity and character matters. There used to be a thing on the radio about character. Character matters. And several illustrations, that was the nature of the program, were used to illustrate the point. But what we want to note is that not everybody's going to heaven. Now, we've established this already. We'll not reiterate these points from these passages. But only certain people will dwell in this dwelling place with God. Not everybody's going to heaven. In our discussion of a lesson some time ago on heaven and hell, we made that point. Not everybody's going to heaven. So some are and some aren't, and we talked about the specifics of that element when we were studying that particular Bible study or sermon lesson. But in our last study, we talked about verse 2 from positive, and we're beginning to discuss verse 4 from a positive standpoint. Who's going to heaven? The man that walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. Who's going to heaven? The man whose eyes a reprobate is despised. The man who honors them that fear Jehovah, and the man that swears to his own hurt and won't change. Now, that is the man that tells the truth. Now, we're going to look at these in a little bit more detail. Not all of these first ones shall we look at in more detail, because we discussed them in detail in our last study. But we will just abbreviate them. The man who walks uprightly. What does it mean to walk uprightly? Somebody commented, I think, last week, we walk like Jesus walked. Well, that's exactly right, and that's what Peter is instructing in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 21 through 23, and would urge you to turn and look at that passage. Had a lesson, a sermon on that not long ago, about following Jesus when times are not good, and looking at the example of Jesus. Randy Childs, if you'd read that, that'll help us a little bit to get the passage in front of us. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 21 through 23.
1 Peter 2, 21 through 23.
Yes, sir.
For you've been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously.
Isn't that simple? You do what Jesus did. What did he do when he was persecuted? Well, did he cast rocks at those that cast rocks at him? Did he spit on those that spit on him? Well, no, he didn't do any of that. And so you walk like Jesus walked. Now, was that easy to do?
It's the entrusting yourself to him who judges righteously.
Yeah.
Where the rubber meets the road.
That's where the rubber meets the road.
If you have faith in God and faith that God's going to see you through it, then you can walk as Jesus.
And if you're going to walk like he walks, we must first of all acknowledge the possibility. It's possible to do that. You can do that. The Bible doesn't teach us to do things that are impossible. So if you want to go to heaven, then you walk like he walked. We looked at Psalms 1 and 2 in our last study, last Lord's Day morning, where the writer said, "Blessed is the man that walketh not after the counsel of the wicked, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of Jehovah, and on his law doth he meditate day and night." And when you read these verses, does it suggest to you that not only can you walk like Jesus walked, but it requires of you something, and that is to learn how he walked? So if you want to go to heaven, then you walk uprightly. Isn't that simple? You walk like he walked. You've got something to learn. If you want to go to heaven and be with God, then you work righteousness. We talked about that last time. What does it mean to work righteousness?
Do right.
Do right. Now that means there has to be a source of what's right and what's wrong. And what is the source?
Psalm 119.
Thy word is righteousness. Now, did we see just in those two illustrations how that it demands something of you? You want to walk uprightly, you want to work righteousness, you've got to learn some things. There has to be a standard. You spend time reading and learning what God has to say. You cannot eliminate the element of learning and go to heaven. You just can't. You remember the statement that Jesus made, all familiar to us? When Jesus said, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." And then what did he say?
Come learn of me.
Well, that requires something of you. You don't know how he walked unless you study. You learn sometimes. Spend time reading, as Randy often says, get your nose in the book, and then you can do that. You do that sincerely, not hypocritically. You look at the character of Cornelius, as we've talked about, a man who walked uprightly and worked righteousness, and when Peter arrived at his house, he said that God is no respecter of persons. But in every nation, he that feareth him and works righteousness is acceptable. Now, how can you know what righteousness is without study? I don't know if it's possible to overdo this point, but I've tried to hammer this point home, that every Bible class you attend, every time you sit down and read from your Bible, every sermon that you listen to, even the songs that we sing are designed to teach and to admonish us how to live. Now, you're putting tools in your toolbox about making decisions and meeting temptations every time you do that. And you say, "Well, wait just a minute, preacher. That particular sermon's not applicable to me today." It might be someday. And if you don't listen and you don't learn the lesson, then you're going to meet the problem without the tools. Now what do you do? You're not going to be working righteousness then. John said in 1 John 2, verse 29, "If ye know that he is righteous, ye know that everyone also that doeth righteousness is begotten of him." Righteousness is something that you do. It's the result of decisions that you make and implement in your life. John again said, "In this the children of God are manifest in the children of the devil. Whosoever doeth not righteousness is not of God." Now, you put that in the equation. If you're not doing righteousness, you're not of God. So whose are you?
Devil.
You belong to the devil. Now, there's nobody else to be. You're either a child of God and you're walking in righteousness, or you're a child of the devil and you're not. Now, that sounds harsh, don't it? That just sounds harsh. But is that what John said?
Reality is harsh.
Pardon me?
Reality is harsh.
It sometimes is, yes. But that's what John said.
You're either a child of the devil or you're a child of God. There's no other place to be. And if you want to go to heaven, then you see what that requires. You work righteousness.
And as the writer continues in Psalm 15, in verse 2, he said, "He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh truth in his heart." Now that's an interesting concept. He speaks truth in his heart. Well, what is the Bible heart?
The mind.
The mind. All right. Now, if you want to speak truth in your heart, you tell yourself the truth. Now, sometimes it's easy to deceive ourselves, and when we do that, then what comes out generally is a lie. You'll note in Matthew 12, verse 34, Jesus said, "Ye offspring of vipers, how can ye, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh." Well, the things that you think, that's generally what comes out, isn't it? Don't most of us find that to be true? Let me ask you a question, and I'm not asking for a show of hands. Perhaps when we were younger, we had some growing up to do, needless to say. And I'm going to suggest that one realm of that growing up, to be different from the world, had to do with our language. Maybe you grow up in the world, maybe you grow up with worldly parents, and you learn words that you know you really ought not use, but you use them anyway, because that's the way everybody talks, right? And maybe sometimes you get after yourself and say, "Boy, I wish I didn't use those words. I wish I didn't talk like that." And maybe you get over that line, but then when something happens, the thoughts are up here. And you really have to work on yourself not to let them come out.
But that's not an age thing.
Not an age thing. No, it is not an age thing. Yeah, but talking to this audience, I'm going to say that I'm talking to a rather mature audience, and we've been there. Every one of us been there, right? We know how that works. And how do you get these thoughts out? We don't want to think those words. Well, you don't want to think those words because if they're up there, they're likely to come out sooner or later. And so we want to get them out from up here. How do we do that? Are we responsible for that?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've got to get them out. Got to get them out. How do you do that?
Replace them with something else.
Yeah, you think on these things. Bible tells you what to think on.
It helps to stop hanging out with people who speak that way.
Big time serious. Yes, sir. Been there, done that. If you don't want to talk that way, you stop associating with people that do. You hang out with people that don't talk that way, and that'll help you more than anything else.
When they have five words in the whole vocabulary, you should be concerned.
Well, that's right. That's right. So be careful about evil companions because they will corrupt good morals. Now, we often think, well, I'll go the other way. I'm going to change whoever. No, you might, but the warning is take heed because evil companions corrupt good morals. And then Ephesians 4 and Colossians 3 and a host of other passages written to those who are Christians. Tell Christians, stop lying. Tell the truth.
The opposite of that is, you know, associate with those that speak well.
Yeah.
There's the other side of the decline.
That's the other side. Yeah, you'll learn how to speak well. Yeah, learn how to do that. All right. So in verse 4 it says, "In whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honoreth them that fear Jehovah, he that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not." When we talk about despising sin, this point sometimes is a point of controversy. Rejects evil people. Well, somebody said, "Well, here's so-and-so, and he's practicing things that are sinful, and so I learned to not like that." No, that's not the point. That's not the point. The idea of rejecting evil people is contingent upon the practices that they engage in what your presence says. Let's turn in our text and read it in Psalm 26 and read beginning in verse 4. Psalm 26, verse 4. The psalmist says, "I have not sat with men of falsehood, neither will I go in with dissemblers. I hate the assembly of evildoers, and will not sit with the wicked." Now, what's the writer saying about those who do wrong things? I just despise them. Is that what he's saying? No. What's he say?
I won't associate
myself. I don't cast my lot with them.
The New American Standard reads a little bit different.
All right, go ahead.
I don't know what a dissembler is, but I do not sit with a deceitful man, nor will I go with pretenders.
All right, that works. Hypocrisy. Yeah, exactly. And the point is, I don't cast my lot there. And why not? Because if you cast your lot with those that are evil people, what did we learn from Psalm 1? The same principle. It's repeated a number of times in the Bible. So if you don't want to be like these folks, then you don't cast your lot with those folks. And again, isn't that a very simple observation that the psalmist is making? And you'll notice this next point. On the contrary, he honors those who fear God.
Now this gets to the point that Glendale was making a few moments ago. If evil companions corrupt good morals, then if you want to cultivate the right kind of morals, then you hang around with the right kind of people. You don't cast your lot with this crowd, but rather you cast your lot with those who honor and those who fear God. In 2 John, or 3 John, in verses 3, I believe it is. No, verse 5. 3 John, verse 5. He said, "Beloved, thou doest a faithful work, and whatsoever thou doest toward them that are brethren and strangers withal, who bear witness to thy love before the church, whom thou wilt do well to set forward on their journey worthily of God, because that for the sake of the name they went forth, taking nothing of the Gentiles, we therefore ought to welcome such, that we may be fellow workers for the truth." Now what's John saying to these folks? Here's folks that are doing what's right, and we ought to be receptive to them. Those who honor and fear God, we need to promote that. And those who don't, then don't. Again, I would say, isn't that simple? So he despises and rejects the sort of person who ought to be despised and rejected of God, who is despised and rejected of God. Now, does that suggest that God doesn't love everybody? Well, that's not the point. God gave his son for everybody. But the evil that they do, he gave his son to forgive. They can't continue to do those things. And if you want to cast your lot there, then you be prepared, because there's bad things. Deuteronomy 25, verse 1. If there be a controversy between men, and they come unto judgment, and the judges judge them, then they shall justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. Now, is that a very simple point? What's the job of a judge?
Righteous judgment.
To render righteous judgment. To condemn the wicked and justify the righteous. But sometimes, what did they have even in the nation of Israel?
Corrupt judges.
Anything new in today's world? Oh, it's always been, you see. But now, if you want to go to heaven, then you've got to have a standard of what's right and what's wrong and abide by that. Again, very simple point. Now, this next point that we want to see in Psalm 15, again, it's all simple. In verse 4, he said, "In whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honoreth them that fear Jehovah, he that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not." Now, I don't think that I did introduce Joshua 9 in our last study, but I want to call your attention to Joshua 9, because when the children of Israel were instructed to go into the land of Canaan, What was their task?
They're supposed to conquer everybody and not associate with them.
That's right. Conquer everybody. Conquer everybody. Now, there was a reason for that. We know that the timing of all of this was because at Abraham's time, the iniquity of the Amorite was not yet full. It was going to get a lot worse. And at the time of the conquering of the land of Canaan, we say, well, Joshua went in, he led those people to destroy everybody. Man, woman, child, we say, well, how's that just? That God brought these people in and took away this land from the inhabitants of it and destroyed men, women, children, destroyed everybody. Well, why did he do that? There'd be no influence later on, but I'm looking for something more.
It was judgment,
yeah. These wicked people, God pronounced judgment upon them. Now, granted, there wouldn't be an influence later on, because that problem would be eliminated. Now, what did the Israelites then begin to do when they came in to conquer the land?
Disobeyed.
They began to make covenants, didn't they, with some of the people. And it came back to bite them because they were troubled by it. Yeah. Now, our text in Joshua chapter 9 cites us a for instance. In Joshua chapter 9, you'll note that it was their job. Let's read beginning in verse 1, Joshua 9. And it came to pass when all the kings were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and the lowland and all the shore of the great sea in front of Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, heard thereof, and they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and with Israel with one accord. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard that Joshua, what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, they also did work wilily. That's a word we don't use very much. What'd they do?
Craftily.
Deceitfully. Okay. It says, and they went and made as if they had been ambassadors and took old sacks upon their asses and wineskins, old and rent and bound up, and old and parched shoes upon their feet and old garments upon them. And all the bread of their provision was dry and became moldy. And they went to Joshua unto the camp of Gilgal, and they said unto him and unto the men of Israel, we are come from a far country. Now therefore make ye a covenant with us. Let's pause right there. Do you see what they've done? What'd they do?
Tricked them.
Yeah. Oh, we've come from a far country. What's the evidence? Well, our bread's all moldy, our clothes are old, our shoes are all worn out. We've traveled a long, long way. And we've heard what you've done to these other folks. And we're not going to be any trouble to you because we're way over yonder. And so what we want you to do is to leave us alone. It says, and the men of Israel said to the Hivites. Now remember, they're just right there. But they make the appearance that they're way off over yonder somewhere. It says, peradventure ye dwell among us, and how shall we make a covenant with you? And they said to Joshua, we are thy servants. And Joshua said unto them, who are you, and from whence come ye? And they said, oh, very far country. Thy servants are come because of the name of Jehovah thy God, and we've heard of the fame of him, and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites and that were beyond Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, who was at Ashera. We've heard all this. So what is it that we want? We want you to leave us alone. Now look at verse 16. And it came to pass at the end of 3 days after they had made a covenant with them. Uh-oh, flag. Not supposed to make any covenants. You can read that in Deuteronomy 7. Don't make any covenants. You destroy all of them. But after 3 days, they made a covenant with them. They that heard that they were their neighbors and that they dwelt among them, and the children of Israel sojourned and came unto their cities on the third day. And their cities were Gibeon, and you can name those. I'm not going to try to pronounce them. And the children of Israel smote them not because the princes of the congregation had sworn unto them by Jehovah, the God of Israel, and all the congregation murmured against the princes. Now, why didn't they kill them?
They made a covenant.
All right. Did the law say something about making covenants?
Said not to.
Said not to. All right. But when you do, what have you done? Say, well, you've disobeyed. That's true. But now read this one. When a man voweth a vow unto Jehovah, or sweareth an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth. Now, they made a promise. Well, granted, they shouldn't have made that promise, but they did. And they invoked the name of Jehovah in making that promise. They shouldn't have done that, but they did. Now what are they obligated to do? Alright, now Glendale brought up an interesting point. You see, they were to destroy these folks, not to make any covenants with them, because it's going to come back and bite you if you do. But they made a covenant. And what happened? Came back and bit them.
They fell for the flattery.
Yeah. Yeah.
We heard about your God.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Now see what happens? You need to keep your word, but don't make these kind of foolish promises to start with. But when you've made them, now what do you do?
Yeah. Well, it's a difficult conundrum because you've made a covenant with somebody to disobey God.
Yeah.
So then, is it right to keep disobeying God because you made a covenant to disobey God?
Ah,
or should you go back and do the original covenant, which was to obey God?
Now, what did these folks do?
They went with that.
They did.
Yeah. They went with, let's keep disobeying God because we promised we would.
Yeah. And Moses required that we do that. Now, here we're looking at a passage in Psalm 15 that says, when you give your word about something, even if it's to your own hurt, you keep it. Now, that doesn't mean you go ahead and commit sin. That's not the point. But you do what you say you will do. Now, I'll tell you what, folks. We need to be careful about making oaths. We need to be careful about what you say you'll do. That's the lesson. Be careful about what you promise. Now, you'll turn in your Bible to the wisdom writer, Ecclesiastes, as Solomon writes that. And I want you to look at what he said in Ecclesiastes, if I can find it, chapter 5. Ecclesiastes, that's the Old Testament, isn't it?
Yeah.
I thought it was. Chapter 5, look, if you will, at verse 4. Ecclesiastes, chapter 5, verse 4. When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it. For he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay what thou vowest. Better it is that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin. Now, what's that saying about what they did with Gibeon? Shouldn't have made that promise. You shouldn't have made that promise. Neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thy hands? For in the multitude of dreams there are vanities, and in many words, but fear thou God. Now, explain that to me. Reconcile that with what we've got in Joshua 9.
It shouldn't have done that.
Careful what you say, careful what you promise.
You do what you say you'll do, but you be careful what you promise. You shouldn't have made that promise. Now notice, if you will, it's better not to make a vow than it is to make a vow and break it. Now, the wisdom writer says in Ecclesiastes, you've made a vow. But it was a mistake. It was a mistake. You see, you don't want your vow to lead you to commit more sin. But just saying, I vowed this and now I'm not happy with it. It was a mistake. I shouldn't have said that. That don't cut it.
Well, Jesus said, let your yes be yes and your no be no.
That's
right. Not to make a vow.
That's right.
So, the whole purpose of making a vow was to convince somebody that you were serious.
Yeah.
But Jesus emphasized that you should be serious before you say yes or before you say no to begin.
Yeah, you should start out being serious. Yeah. So point is, you tell the truth. You tell the truth and you be careful about what you say that you will do. That should not be complicated. It should not.
So guard your words.
Pardon me?
You guard your words.
Guard your words. Be careful what you promise that you will do. And, of course, this writer is telling us that when you make a vow, and we used the illustration, I may have brought up this point last week. It seems like maybe I did. Used the illustration of agreeing to sell an automobile for $100. And then later you find out, well, my automobile's worth $1,000. So I've agreed to sell it for $100, but now I find out it's worth $1,000, so now I won't sell it unless you pay me $1,000. Well, is it going to hurt you financially to not collect the $1,000? Well, yeah. But what you say you'd do?
Sell it for $100.
You said you'd sell it for $100. So you made a promise to do that. Now what must you do?
Keep your promise.
Sell it for $100. That's what you said you'd do. Now, we say, yeah, but it was a mistake. I found out now that it's worth $1,000. No. You best not make a vow. But now that you have, you're obligated to keep it.
Because your word is more valuable
than... That's right. Your word's worth more than $1,000. Carolyn?
I can't find it, but the parable where the one says he'll go work in the field and then he doesn't, and the other says he's not going to go, but then he does, and he does right. The one who didn't promise to do it, but then he went and did right anyway, is the one that is in the right. And it's kind of the same principle.
It is.
You know, don't say you're going to do it and then don't do it. Better to not say anything at all.
It is, and that's in my lesson on repentance, and I can't tell you the passage offhand. It's on the left-hand page, left-hand column, about a third of the way down.
Matthew 21:29.
There it is. Okay. Thank you, Glenn.
Last week, car was only $500, not
$1,000. Oh, okay. Well, sorry about that. It went up this week. Time. Terrible. Time. All right, so the integrity of your word is worth something, and so you've got to sustain that. All right. Now, we've looked at stated positively, the man who's going to heaven is the man that walks uprightly. He works righteousness, he speaks the truth, he despises sin, he honors reverence, he keeps his word. Isn't that simple? Here's the man that's answered the question. He's going to heaven. He'll be with God. Now, what's the other side of that coin? Well, the other side's in verse 3 and in verse 5. He that slandereth not with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his friend, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor. He that poureth not out his money to interest, nor taketh reward against the innocent. He that doeth these things shall never be moved. Now let's examine the negative side of that. Stated negatively, the man who goes to heaven, he's the man that doesn't fuss and fume and use his ability of speech to harm and do hurt. To folks, he slandereth not with his tongue. Well, the Bible addresses that so many times. Look, if you would, please, at Romans 1. Romans 1. Now, the context of Romans 1 is always interesting to me because it's indicating those who become the objects of God's wrath. Those who practice ungodliness and unrighteousness, verse 18. Well, what are some of those things? Well, dropping down into that text, if you look at verse 28 beginning, he said, even as they refused to have God in their knowledge, God gave them up unto a reprobate mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignity, whispers, backbiters. There's what we're looking at. Hateful to God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, unmerciful, who knowing the ordinance of God that they that practice such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but also consent with them that practice them. Now, it's not our purpose to define all of these words in this context, but I simply want to focus on one. On this term, backbiter. Slander. Well, what is it to slander somebody?
Go ahead.
Assassinate somebody's character. Yeah.
Speak negatively.
Yeah. Often when they're not around. Yeah. You're trying to kill them. Yeah.
My question is, would it be speak when that person's not around and they are?
I'm having trouble here.
I said, the slander in the context, you speak that upon an individual that you're doing in their face.
Yeah. Well, if you're doing it right in front of them, maybe that gives them an opportunity to explain that maybe things are not always like they're perceived to be. That's a possibility, yeah. But to backbite is to do it behind their back.
They don't have a chance
to explain or defend. That's not good.
And especially when you act like they're friends to their face.
Well, that's hypocritical. Yeah, you're acting like a friend to their face, and then when you're turned, you stab them. Yeah, that's what he's talking about. You see, can't go to heaven to do that kind of thing. Isn't that interesting? But how common is that? Oh, that's just commonplace, especially in school, work environment. Yeah, hear that all the time. I know from the 10 years that I was substituting in Arkansas, you'd have a student come to me and they'd say, so-and-so's talking about me. That was just commonplace. They're talking about me. They're telling things. Well, that happens, don't it? That happens in society. It happens in work. It happens in school. It happens sometimes, unfortunately, in the church. It does. And that's not right. But we need to see what it is. And what we learn here is the man that's going to heaven, he's the fellow that don't do that. Isn't that simple? He don't do that. Well, why don't he do that?
It's not a work of righteousness.
It's not a work of righteousness. He don't do that because he wants to go to heaven. Common occurrence. And
Sometimes maybe we need to have a sit down face to face and talk about what's on our minds. But to assassinate somebody's character, not right. Can't do that. It is possible that I can be mistaken. I may have misunderstood something. Or I may have understood it exactly right, and he is what you represented him to be. And he needs to be confronted. And so there you have it. But the man that goes to heaven, he doesn't participate in this. You'll notice in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, let's look again. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, reading in verse 19. Verse 19, the writer said, "Ye think all this time that we are excusing ourselves unto you in the sight of God, speak we in Christ. But all things, beloved, are for your edifying. For I fear lest by any means when I come I should find you not such as I would, and should myself be found of you such as ye would not. Lest by any means there should be," now look at the list, "strife, jealousy, wrath, factions, backbitings, whisperings, swellings, tumults. Lest again when I come my God should humble me before you and I should mourn for many of them that have sinned heretofore and repented not of the uncleanness and fornication and lasciviousness which they have committed." Now get the point that Paul is making. When Paul comes to Corinth, he's writing this from Macedonia, but he's on his way to Corinth. And he's already addressed many of these things in the 1 Corinthian letter. And if they've not fixed it by the time he gets there, what's he going to do about it? He's going to confront them about it. And he says, "I'm afraid when I get there, I won't find you like I want to find you. And you won't find me like you expect to find me." Now get that. Paul's not going to let this slide. If they're guilty of these things, he's going to address it. The Apostle Peter also addressed this in 1 Peter chapter 2 and in verse 1. Now, I think it's interesting, the context. We've hammered and hammered and hammered context, 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 and the use of words in their context. And the word that's used here is a word that has its background in somebody that's a spy. You find that interesting? Perhaps even a little bit humorous as far as the application is concerned. What does a spy do? What's his job? Expose other people's secrets. That's right. But how does he present himself to the person that he's reporting on? "I'm a friend of you. But as soon as your back's turned, I'm going to turn you in. I'm going to accuse you of something." That's a backbiter. That's what he does. That's a slanderer. That's what he does. Alright? So we need to see how that's used. And as the psalmist says, he doesn't do evil to his neighbor. Well, you see, obviously, these two are very closely related. Doesn't do evil to his friend, reading from the American Standard translation. Doesn't do evil to his neighbor. Well, familiar thought, isn't it? And backbiter, yeah, he's a backbiter. Jesus dealt with this in the Sermon on the Mount. Familiar text to us. The writer says, if you want to be treated right, then how do you treat your neighbor? You treat him like you want to be treated. Isn't that simple? You treat your neighbor like you want to be treated. Matthew 7, verse 12. Now, if you don't think you'd like being treated that way, then you don't treat other folks that way. The wisdom writer, again, in Proverbs 24, said it this way in verse 29. "Say not, I will do so to him as he hath done to me. I will render to a man according to his work." Now, how many of you have siblings?
Going to get even with you.
Going to get even, yeah. He hit me, and I had to hit him back. Fight was on. Now, what is it the wisdom writer said in Proverbs 24:29?
Don't do that.
Ain't that simple? The man who goes to heaven, he don't do that. My day will come, I'll get even. And so we lie in wait. He hit me and I'm going to hit him back. I don't know how many times my brother and I tried to use that on our parents. You know how many times it worked? None. Now, if you think it don't work with parents, what do you think it's going to do with God? Well, Paul said it this way, if you'll turn to the text, I don't know if I have it on the chart or not. Don't see it readily. But in Romans chapter 12, beginning in verse 18, Now look at your Bible, Romans chapter 12, verse 18. He said, if it be possible, as much as in you lieth, be at peace with all men. Avenge not yourselves, beloved, but give place to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance belongeth unto me, I will recompense, saith the Lord. But if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him to drink, for in so doing thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. Now we read this passage and we understand what it says, but it's the application of what it says that sometimes presents us problems. Isn't that true? Like when you get into a spat with your brother.
My dad, we start pointing fingers at each other when we got into a conflict, you know, and he just whipped us both.
Oh, no.
Get the right one now.
Yeah, be sure and get the right one that way. Yeah, your dad must have known my dad.
I was just going to say, in contrast, what Jesus said in Matthew 18:15, if your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you've won your brother. Of course, it continues there, but the whole point is, instead of going backbiting, instead of going and telling everybody what my brother did against me.
Or waiting for the day to get even.
I'm supposed to go to him and talk to him about it.
Yeah.
Private.
Yeah. You mean as much as in me is to be at peace with all men. Yeah. That's how you handle that. But we don't want to do that. And why don't we want to do that?
Pride.
Yeah. We're going to settle the score. I've got to wind up on top, and that's...
Yeah, but if it costs your soul, what is it worth?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, when the Apostle Peter is writing this same thing, we read it a few moments ago, Randy did, what we're trying to do is emulate what the Lord would do. Question?
So back to the point where if they hit me, I have to put them back to get even. If it's self-defense, is that different?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up in some way. I'll save by the bell. Well, I don't believe that anybody is obligated by the Lord to just present themselves as a punching bag and say, just beat me up. You know, I need to avail myself of every opportunity to escape. I need to do that. When I don't have any opportunity to escape, then I need to do what Peter did, and others did, to try to defend myself. I believe that's a fact. I disagree with some who take the position that we are not to defend ourselves in any respect. There was a preacher, his name was Bill Emmerich, that I got acquainted with a long, long time ago, probably about 45 years ago. I don't know if he's even still living. But he took the position that if somebody broke into his house, that... with his wife and two children, I believe he had two, maybe three, that there was nothing that he was to do to try to defend his house or his family. No, I deny that. My point to him was then that if somebody breaks into my house and does bad things to one of my daughters, I don't believe that I'm obligated to tell him, I've got another daughter upstairs, if you want her too, you can. I don't believe that. It'll be over everything in my power to stop him. Because one of the things that I'm persuaded that I'm to provide for myself and my family is safe environment. I'm to provide them with some means of protection. Now that's my views on that. That may not answer your question as detailed as you'd like, but I think it points you in the right direction. Any other comments on that? And I would dare say that most of us are the same way. Now what we look at the Lord came, and what we learn in the text, 1 Peter chapter 2, is they crucified him. Now, did he present any kind of opposition to that? Did he fight with the Roman soldiers to try to live? No, why?
He was doing his Father's will.
He came to do the Father's will. And to offer himself in that way was what was necessary for sins to be forgiven, you see. So we want to look at that perhaps in a little bit different light of defending life and limb of people that I'm obligated to protect, including me. Okay, does that help, Randy?
But I guess the issue then is, what did Jesus mean when he said to turn the other cheek?
Yeah.
And how far does that go?
Yeah, that's the question. How far does that go?
Yes. The illustration that Jesus gave is, that's the point when you turn the other cheek. Yeah. You don't punch it back.
I know.
No. But what if the blows keep coming? Yeah. And that's really the question.
Yeah.
If it's not just, if your brother strikes you, but if your brother keeps striking you,
yeah,
you have the right to run.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah. It's an interesting issue.
It is an interesting issue, but we're varying just a little bit from the idea of taking upon myself vengeance. Mm-hmm. Vengeance belongs to the Lord, and there's a difference in defending yourself and seeking vengeance. You see the difference? Okay. He hit me, and I'll hit him back. Well, what am I trying to do but equal the score? No, that's not the purpose of things. That's not what motive should be. Okay. That's an interesting question. We'll have to talk some more about that. All right? Does it spread damaging reports of a friend? Well, you see that again. Psalm 15, in the text of verse 3, he doesn't do evil to a friend. Well, what does that mean that we do? And I guess this gets back to your point over here about somebody's been a backbiter, then what do I do? Well, I don't want to be the backbiter, first of all. I don't want to do that. But one of the things that I do want to do is to examine myself, and that's what this text teaches. And if it be possible, we've read that in Romans 12, be at peace with all men. As much as it is possible, I want to be at peace with all men. So I want to examine myself, make sure I'm doing right.
He says that would be possible. That implies that it's not always possible.
Not always possible. It wasn't possible with the Lord. They killed him. You see?
And all the apostles were martyred except John.
That's right. That's right.
Paul said he's going to be, he's pouring his life out.
That's right.
He knew his end was coming.
The Apostle Peter in John 21 was told by the Lord that he was going to be a martyr. He refers to it in 2 Peter 1, what the Lord told him. And he says, not far down the road. That's the second bell. Oh, man. Okay. Well, we'll have to come back. I thought I'd surely finish Psalm 15 in our study this morning. But we'll come back to this again. Next time, if we get through Psalm 15, we'll be in Psalm 125. So make a note of that somewhere. Psalm 125.